Thank you, Your Honor. May I please the court? My name is Jonathan Rikuchi, attorney registration 30069, appearing on behalf of Mr. Sandoval, who remains incarcerated in a correctional facility in Colorado. A jury convicted Mr. Sandoval of child enticement in September 2004. Prior to the trial, the court file totaled 9 pages, which included only the information in a search warrant affidavit. Not a single motion of any kind was ever filed. Including the jury instructions and verdict form, the court file totaled 27 pages at the time of conviction. Mr. Sandoval was sentenced to a 4-to-life indeterminate sentence under the Lifetime Supervision Act in November 2004. He maintained his innocence at that time. A decade later, he still maintains his innocence, and he's still incarcerated. Because that he has throughout maintained his innocence, the Department of Corrections will not allow him to participate in sex offender treatment. Participation in the treatment program, however, is a mandatory and absolute prerequisite to release on parole. Given this profound disincentive to continue to claim innocence, logic suggests that Mr. Sandoval's assertion should be taken quite seriously. I offer this backdrop for what this court already surely knows. This is an extremely serious case. This court's decisions will very likely decide Mr. Sandoval's fate and whether he will die in prison. I'd like to use the lion's share of my time to address the ineffective assistance of counsel claim, because that claim provides the most straightforward grounds for meaningful relief, which in this case would be a new, fair trial with competent counsel. A proper and straightforward application of Strickland versus Washington leads to this result. This case was a classic credibility contest, and it presents a quintessential example of unreasonable performance under Strickland. Here, the jury heard that Mr. Sandoval had been previously charged with vehicular homicide, meaning he killed someone, and that he served 4 years in prison for it. This evidence was irrelevant and terribly prejudicial, as the division in the Sandoval 2 made clear.
Counsel, go ahead. But counsel didn't ask him for that information. He asked him what he'd been convicted of, and the defendant volunteered that he'd been charged with that. That's not counsel's fault.
I acknowledge that the defendant did volunteer that. However, the damage had already been done at this point in time. The damage was done when counsel failed to object when the prosecutor indicated his intent to elicit the original charge, the sentence, and the actual conviction.
But that wasn't damage. You're saying the damage is the jury heard about the charge. The jury didn't hear these discussions or these objections or these lack of objections before trial. The only harm that could have occurred is before the jury.
Sure, but I agree with that.
So the harm hadn't been done. I mean,
the harm was done. The harm was done with the failure to object, because a simple objection, a proper objection, at the proper time, would have made it clear that that evidence was not admissible. If Mr. Sandoval had then volunteered that information, this would be a different case. That's not what happened. And so it was the failure to object, which would have succeeded. It was the failure to object that produced the result. And
that sounds entirely speculative to me. I mean, it assumes that, one, the trial court would have ruled in favor, and second, that the defendant would have heard about it somehow and then instructed not to disclose that information, and third, that he wasn't so instructed, none of which we have from the record.
Well, that's not accurate, Your Honor. The law in this state has been settled for 22 years or more that this kind of information is not admissible. So a proper objection, it's not speculation to suggest that a proper objection would have eliminated the ability of the prosecution to elicit that testimony.
But didn't the trial court essentially find that Mr. Sandoval was, as I'll put it, an uncontrollable witness based upon his performance during the post-conviction hearing, and aren't we bound by that? How do we get around that?
The judge did find that, Your Honor, but that's the part that's speculative. What's speculative here is that the trial judge went back to review the error which occurred at the Curtis advisement, an error which even the trial judge recognized was clearly erroneous statement of law and sufficiently prejudicial that if it would have been raised on direct appeal, it would have met the plain error standard. And so when you take what happens 10 minutes later to justify that error, you're doing exactly what Strickland versus Washington precludes, hindsight, distorting effects of hindsight. The question that this court has to answer is whether or not there was a reasonable strategic decision to not object. That question has not been answered. That question was not answered by the trial court. The trial court did not make any findings on whether there was a duty to object, and if whether the objection, failure to object, was a strategic decision, and if so, whether it was reasonable. And so certainly the judge's credibility determinations do not help Mr. Sandoval's cause. I recognize that. But this evaluation is about counsel's performance, not Mr. Sandoval's performance, 10 years later or 8 years later.
If counsel told Mr. Sandoval, whatever you do when you get up on the witness stand, don't talk about vehicular homicide charge. And notwithstanding that, Mr. Sandoval blurted out, oh, it started out as a vehicular homicide charge and plea bargained it down to vehicular assault. Under those facts, you'd have no argument here, right?
No, not. I don't think that's quite correct, Your Honor. That would be a different case. But if counsel had told Sandoval that, and there's no evidence in the record that that occurred, and in fact, Mr. Hammond, who reviewed trial counsel's file, indicated that there was nothing in that file to indicate that any sort of preparation along those lines had been done. But if it had, that would be a different case, but that would not justify the initial failure to object. It's at that point in time that counsel has a duty to protect the defendant. And sure, if Mr. Sandoval turned out to be uncontrollable and offered that thereafter, it would be a different case. But that doesn't eliminate the foremost duty in the first instance to know the law and to make the proper objection.
But isn't that hypothetical I gave you when you then apply the post-conviction court's findings, isn't that this case?
Well, I don't think so, Your Honor. I don't think so. If Mr. Sandoval's not a credible witness, then that may, he may have volunteered that. But it's just as likely that, what he did was he literally parroted back what the prosecutor had said. The prosecutor told the judge during the Curtis advisement that this was initially a vehicular homicide that was pled down. 10 minutes later, that's exactly what Mr. Sandoval testified to, and there was nothing on the record to trigger a knowledge on his part not to say that. In fact, the court during the Curtis advisement told Mr. Sandoval that if he's been convicted of a felony, the prosecutor will be entitled to ask you about any such conviction and thereby disclose such conviction to the jury. There's nothing about that Curtis advisement that tells him that this is limited to the fact of conviction. It tells him that he's going to be asked about it. And so it was incumbent upon the defense counsel at that point in time to make this objection, to make it clear that the Colorado law did not allow this type of evidence. And there's a reason it doesn't allow this type of evidence, because this type of evidence made a fair trial an impossibility. The jury heard that Mr. Sandoval had killed somebody and that he had spent 4 years in prison for it. You cannot unring that bell. A drop of ink cannot be separated from a glass of milk. The damage was done and it was profound. This is, as I said, it was a classic credibility contest. The Sandoval Division 2 found that this was not a case of overwhelming guilt. The Attorney General conceded that fact last time we were here in 2011. And, if the court were to find that because Mr. Sandoval volunteered that information, that alleviated counsel's duty to object in the first instance, the court would still be left with the fact that trial counsel elicited the sentence.
What's the prejudice of having disclosed, once it's disclosed permissibly that he was found, that he was convicted of vehicle assault, what is the prejudice to defendant in that there was a four-year sentence.
The prejudice to the defendant is that a jury, having just heard that he had killed somebody, was told that he spent 4 years in prison. A jury, any reasonable jury, could very easily have said, what the heck? He killed somebody and he did 4 years in prison? So it signaled to the jury that he hadn't been properly punished for the prior conviction. And it also indicated to the jury that he had just gotten off parole. And he had literally gotten off parole in the last year and was out there committing new offenses. So it was terribly prejudicial.
So you're saying the jury likely thought that the sentence was too light?
I think that's certainly a fair possibility.
But isn't that total speculation?
Well, that's exactly what the Attorney General said in 2011 on November 7th when we were in this court. He said that this was the jury may have thought this was a lenient sentence, and therefore Mr. Sandoval had to disclose it to the jury to present himself as having someone who had taken responsibility. And so I'd like to reserve the rest of my time, but the Cheatham case from Kansas is exactly on point. And that case is cited in my reply brief. It's a 2013 case from Kansas. It makes clear that courts cannot pass off a lawyer's failure to object to prior criminal history as the responsibility of the client. Strickland requires the focus to stay on the lawyer. Thank you. If I could reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you.
May it please the court, my name is Ryan Crane, attorney registration 37842, and I represent the people on this case. I think the best way to look at this case is to understand how we got here. And the way we got here, of course, is a remand from the court. What this court said in Sandoval 2, as opposing counsel alluded to, was we can't determine based on this record why defendant responded the way he did when he was asked about his prior conviction. Why did he respond with the prior charge instead of the prior conviction when he was asked? What the district court found, now that we've had that evidentiary hearing, and now that we have the facts that we need, we have a record now saying the defendant was prepared by counsel. Counsel likely persuaded him or tried to persuade him not to testify at all because it was very difficult to control. He was unmanageable. He was damaging to his case of trial, just like he was at the post-conviction hearing, as evidenced by the district court's assessment of his credibility and demeanor on the stand. So now that we have that finding, we know he was prepared to testify by counsel as best counsel could. We don't know the specifics of what was said to him, but we know counsel did some work in trying to prepare him. We know his answer was non-responsive and volunteered. I think the district court's word was spontaneously or blurting it out or impulsively, and that's the nature of the way he testified, generally speaking.
Could you respond to Mr. Rapucci's argument that the harm was essentially done at the time that counsel did not object to the prosecutor's intention to bring this information before the jury?
Certainly, Your Honor. I think what he means is that the error was already committed by counsel when counsel failed to object. I think an argument could be made it would have been helpful for counsel to object at that time. We don't know because it didn't happen. What we do know is the Constitution doesn't require a lawyer to object to announcements by the other side, as the court has already pointed out. What a lawyer must do is keep inadmissible evidence out to the best he or she is able. In this case, the defense counsel couldn't foresee what defendant was going to volunteer non-responsively as a result of a question that he didn't ask. So I think that's what was being referred to in the sense that the harm was already done. I mean, the idea that the defendant then heard that the prosecutor said that and then went along with that and parroted it back, that to me is entirely speculative. But I think his point was that the harm was done in the sense that counsel didn't object at that time, but that it wasn't. The prejudice hadn't ensued is, I think, what's the salient point here. And counsel could have undone whatever harm you would assume happened there by just objecting at the time of trial, which is what he was you know, what could have been done if the prosecutor had tried to elicit something improper.
The post-conviction court seemed to spend a lot of time discussing whose decision it was for the defendant to testify, and I was a little lost as to what that had to do with this case. Why do we care about that now?
My understanding of reading the district court's order is that the court was trying to infer, the court was discussing that in the context of understanding or supporting its belief that Sandoval was an unmanageable client and he was a harmful client to his own cause. The district court therefore read the Curtis advisement and noted that the way Sandoval answered was, the court said something like, I know you've spoken with your attorney. Have you now had a chance to make your decision? He said, yes, I'm going to testify. It seemed to me that the district court was reading that and reading some of the other context in which the case occurred and the way Sandoval testified to say, I find it more likely than not, counsel recommended he not testify because he was very damaging to his cause. And in addition to the way that he answered the Curtis advisement, which I didn't quote the exact language, but it was something that sounded like it was possible that he was going against counsel's advice. What the district court had said at trial was, I'm aware you've discussed this with your attorney, but have you had enough time to make a decision? Yes, Your Honor, I have. I choose to testify. So you're choosing to testify? Yes, sir. You know, you can draw, if you can draw any conclusion from that, I think the court's point was, it seemed like there was potentially disagreement between counsel, and it further supported its finding in that regard by saying, counsel also got him off the stand right after cross-examination. Counsel did not allow any redirect examination because he was damaging to his case. Counsel had to go by his decision by saying, I want to testify, but counsel then got him off the stand immediately after cross.
Counsel.
To avoid any further damage in the case.
Excuse me. As I understand it, the trial court made a finding that Mr. Sandoval, his attorney never met with him. Mr. Sandoval testified that his attorney never met with him to discuss his testimony or the prior conviction. The transcript seems to show that that's not what Mr. Sandoval said. He did admit those facts on his direct examination. Does that undercut, should we give a lot less weight to the judge's findings of fact in light of that discrepancy?
Well, my reading of the district court order was that the court said Sandoval initially denied that counsel had ever discussed with them the prior conviction, but that later, I think the court said begrudgingly, he admitted on cross-examination that counsel had discussed with him the prior conviction. And the court found Sandoval's testimony to be incredible, generally speaking. So
you're saying initially, do you agree that initially he testified that he had not met with his counsel on these subjects?
Mm-hmm. I believe that's the district court's finding was yes, initially on direct.
I'm asking if there's testimony to support that.
That he said that on direct and then contradicted himself and admitted it on cross-examination?
Right. As I understand it, he made those, the testimony where he admitted to having done that was during his direct examination.
Oh, it was during direct. I haven't reviewed that portion of the transcript to confirm that. I don't think it changes the result here because the ultimate point was he's not a credible witness and he at first seemed to be denying this and then eventually admitted, but I think what really matters is counsel did meet with him about it and prepared, you know, discussed the matter with him. I think that was what really mattered eventually. I don't think we need to throw out the district court's findings just if it was confused about when or what time he admitted to what. So I guess that leaves us with a question about the sentence. And I understand defense counsel's argument, but I think we're left with what occurred is the defendant himself volunteered this matter about the prior conviction or the prior charge. Counsel properly admitted it on direct. Counsel properly elicited the prior conviction, but with the defendant responding with the initial charge instead, that was not due to counsel's performance at all. And so what you're left with is the only thing that could be said to be deficient performance is counsel's eliciting of the sentence. I think there's an argument to be made based on the transcript that counsel was trying to do that strategically to show the jury defendant had taken responsibility and the case was closed and moved on. That's the way he framed the entire thing at trial. But even assuming that that's not a potentially constitutional viable strategy, even then you're left with the only thing that was improperly admitted then, assuming that was counsel's fault or improper, is that the jury knew there was a four-year sentence, but it already knew that he'd been convicted of a felony. That in and of itself is certainly not sufficiently prejudicial to sustain defendant's burden here of establishing by essentially a preponderance of the evidence that the result would have been different if defendant had not.
Give me your thought process. I mean, how do you reach that conclusion?
I reach it, Your Honor, because this was a two-day trial, and if you read the testimony and the transcript of the trial, first of all, I would, you know, whatever, however many documents were filed before trial, nine documents or whatever, if you read this trial transcript, defense counsel did an excellent job, and I mean that. I mean, I summarized everything that he did in the prior appeal before this court, but I mean, he consistently stuck with his theme throughout. He cross-examined every witness and furthered that theme with every witness. His theme was, you know, this girl was only 12 or 13. She made a little lie out based on seeing Mr. Sandoval, and then later she got caught in it when everybody freaked out and called police. And he hammered that home as best he could. The problem was the jury just had no good explanation for why this girl would be going on with this for years, saying, that's what Sandoval did to me. I was crying on the side of the street when she hadn't seen him in 2 years. And his explanation, especially given his demeanor on the stand, which was entirely incredible, that, well, I just waved to her and drove on. I don't know why she made all this up. The jury, that's what they had to do. And so whether or not there was a four-year sentence, that was just not enough to tip the scales as far
as... When you talk about demeanor, are you talking about at the post-conviction hearing or at the trial?
Both, Your Honor, because...
How do we know that?
The post-conviction court specifically found that he testified in the same manner at the post-conviction hearing as he did at trial. And I think the trial transcript...
And he was the trial judge?
He was not, but he said based on reading the transcripts.
I don't know how you determine from the transcript that someone's demeanor is incredible. How do you do that?
Well, here's an example. Even on direct examination at trial and in cross-examination with the prosecutor, he would volunteer information that was totally non-responsive. And I can think of one specific example when the prosecutor asked him a question about whether he goes to bars, and he had responded with something like, no, I don't like to drink socially, I drink at home, which wouldn't seem to be helpful to his case. Later, the prosecutor asked a question, and he non-responsively went off on a tangent that seemed like something he thought would place him in a good light, but it had nothing to do with the case. And so it seemed to me, just by reading the transcript, the district court was correct in post-conviction review to say he testified the same way at the trial, it looks like, as he did here. He's all over the place. He's unmanageable. That's the reason.
Are you going to address the constitutional claims?
I will, if the court would like.
I would like.
As I noted, I don't think most of the defendant's arguments were properly set forth at all in the opening brief, and that's why I didn't address them. The one that was actually fleshed out and supported with case law and explanation with citation was one regarding the alleged denial of the right to be free from compelled self-incrimination. And the problems with that argument are, number one, I don't think he's being compelled at all. He's been issued a valid sentence that this court has upheld within the realm of the sentencing scheme that's applicable here. The only problem is he's being denied parole because he's not willing to admit to the crime that the system has already found he committed. So his entire claim is based on the idea that he can deny what the system has already found he did. And really all of his claims are based on that notion that he's been found guilty, but he now has a constitutional right to deny that and still receive some sort of benefit like parole.
Was he required to admit not only the crime that he was convicted of, but any other unlawful sexual acts?
Well, he's not alleging that he has committed any other unlawful sexual acts.
No, I know, but would the regulations have required that as well?
That I don't know. But I don't think it matters here because defendant is not alleging that he has anything like that that precludes him. All he has said specifically is, I don't want to admit to this crime, and so I shouldn't have to. I don't think he's being compelled. I don't think he's incriminating himself at all because he's already been convicted and the conviction has been upheld on direct appeal.
Are you believe that the post-conviction court was correct in ruling that these constitutional challenges were successive, or are you taking a different tack?
You know, I think there's an argument to be made there, but I was trying to take, I mean, defendant insisted in his opening brief, no, these are as-applied challenges. They wouldn't have been ripe until I was actually denied parole. And so that's the approach he took. So I just went with that and said, okay, assuming that's true, it wasn't ripe until this time. And so he's added them. Under that argument, they couldn't have been raised in a prior post-conviction motion because he wasn't denied parole, he says, or these facts didn't arise until after his prior post-conviction motion was filed. So that's the reason I took the approach I did, 35C3, one that precludes claims that could have been raised in a prior post-conviction motion. It accepts claims that where the facts hadn't arisen yet at the time.
So you assume that those facts hadn't arisen and are challenging it on the basis that he didn't really appropriately argue those claims?
Most of them, and I specifically addressed the merits of the compelled self-incrimination claim.
Counsel, with respect to the motion that was attached, assuming we're not required to consider, do we have the discretion to consider those arguments?
I think the court would. I think it would probably, I mean, I can't tell the court that it can't do something like that. I think it would go against the spirit of the court's rules, which are, you know, when you have a maximum length word limit brief, and you can't fully understand the argument without referring back to a 23-page single-spaced district court motion, that's the definition of incorporation by reference. And so that's why I didn't think it was appropriate for me also to, you know, respond to a paragraph here and a paragraph there with a, you know, a treatise on constitutional law. I don't think that's appropriate. I don't think that's what this court's rules allow for. Counsel certainly could have sought an overnight brief, but didn't do so. Because there's no further questions, I'll thank the court for its time and ask that the order of denial be affirmed.
Has any Colorado court addressed his First Amendment argument? His argument that he has a constitutional right not to speak?
I'm not aware of any. No. Thank you. I'm going to try to speak quickly. One thing I did want to point out, Your Honor, Judge Berger indicated that the court had found that the motion was successive. That, in fact, is not an order that exists. That order was entered at the time that I filed the motion. It was entered the same day, frankly, and that the court didn't have jurisdiction at that point. And I alerted the court to that, and the court vacated that order. So the court did not find that it was successive. What the court found was two reasons. One, that it had been repeatedly rejected. My claims have been repeatedly rejected by the appellate court. This is simply an act. No court has rejected these claims. They're as-applied claims. This is a unique factual circumstance where Mr. Sandoval passes polygraph tests when he denies not only this case, but also other cases. Therefore, and he sticks to it, I'm innocent. If he were, for example, to change his tune, guess what? He's going to fail this polygraph test, and that in and of itself would be reason to keep him out of treatment. So this literally is a case with unique facts. It's Kafka-esque. It brings to the surface all of the problems with the indeterminate sentence. And, you know, those challenges were thoughtful, they were substantive. I worked awfully hard on those challenges. I did everything in my power to preserve those challenges. And, you know, to the extent that I wasn't able to put them in the brief in a way that's meaningful, I reject that. I reject that. I think this court does have discretion to consider the motion itself, and frankly, I think the court has a duty to consider the motion itself. That's the application for post-conviction relief. And it's substantive and it's complex, and it all comes down to one fact. One fact. That fact is that Mr. Sandoval, the Department of Corrections, will not allow Mr. Sandoval to participate in treatment because he maintains his innocence.
But that was known at the time of the first post-conviction motion, wasn't it?
Well,
knew that then. What I guess what I'm trying to get at is I'd like you to articulate precisely how under these circumstances, the, as you describe it, as-applied challenge really differs in substance from the facial challenge that was made earlier?
Well, it's hard to do that in a minute, but I'll try. You know, it's different because it relates to Mr. Sandoval's own claim. This is an individual. This is a person who's going to spend the rest of his life in prison. And Mr. Sandoval deferred parole, his parole hearing, for several times in order to put together a package where he got took lie detector tests, put together a meaningful package. That meaningful package did not hit the court, did not hit the parole board until after his post-conviction claims had been filed, and after he'd twice been denied parole. At that point, that's when it became very clear that as applied to this individual, those regulations, the enabling statutes, are not going to achieve the purposes of the statute. And in fact, like I argued in my application and in the brief, it literally has taken the sentence in this case, as applied to Mr. Sandoval, and has turned it into from an indeterminate sentence to a de facto life sentence. These are really important issues.
Counsel, I hate to interrupt, but we don't have much time, and we can go beyond the time here, but what is the remedy you want for the sentence? I mean, what do you want his sentence declared unconstitutional? I understand that, but what goes in its place?
Well, obviously that's not an easy answer. I think what would have to go in its place, I think the short answer that I would like to get to is F4 determinate sentencing, as opposed to F4 indeterminate sentencing. I mean, if the indeterminate scheme is not going to allow him the treatment that the scheme itself is designed to give every offender in order to protect society and to gain this treatment, then the indeterminate scheme, it's a farce. It's not, and this case is unique. It is different than the facial challenges, and it all comes down to the one fact that I've done. And I pled those claims as well as I possibly could, as detailed as I could, and they warrant, you know, they state colorable claims. That's the standard. They weren't successive. They state colorable claims. And Mr. Sandoval should have an opportunity to prove those claims. I appreciate the extra time, and I appreciate the fair consideration of this case.
Thank you for your excellent arguments, counsel. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will be issued in due course.